Today's Thursday, August 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The American-led effort to evacuate people from Kabul's international airport continues.
A total of approximately 19,000 people were evacuated over a period of 24 hours.
While rights groups still struggle to get good information on what's happening in more remote areas.
Partly that's because the Taliban have cut cell phone service in many of these areas.
And the WHO says the data on COVID-19 booster shots is inconclusive as manufacturers release data showing otherwise. These stories and more next. With less than a week remaining before it pulls its last troops out of Afghanistan, the United States continues evacuating people from Kabul's international airport. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki provided a recap of U.S.-led efforts during a briefing at the White House on Wednesday.
A total of approximately 19,000 people were evacuated from Kabul over a period of 24 hours that, of course, ended early this morning. This is the result of 42 U.S. military flights, which carried approximately 11,200 evacuees, and 48 coalition flights, which carried 7,800 people for a total of 90 flights out of Kabul, which, if I get my math right, that's approximately a flight every 39 minutes. I believe the Department of Defense gave that statistic. And just to reiterate, since August 14th, the United States has evacuated and facilitated the evacuation of approximately 82,300 people on U.S. military and coalition flights.
Even so, officials said another 10,000 people have crammed into the international airport in Kabul, hoping to escape the country controlled by Taliban insurgents. The scene at Hamid Karzai International Airport remains tense and chaotic, but Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said it will not be an American responsibility to control airport security after August 31st, the date in which U.S. President Joe Biden has set for ending U.S. military operations in Afghanistan. Officials said that they also know that there are a lot of desperate people who want to leave. Psaki also responded to a reporter's question at that briefing about the administration's agreement with the Taliban to allow those with proper paperwork to enter the airport, and reports that some people can't get through Taliban checkpoints.
There are certainly cases and incidents, and we have heard, you have reported, where individuals are not getting through that should get through. And we are approaching those and addressing those on a case-by-case basis as those are raised. But I would note that, again, 19,000 people in a period of time, the vast majority of them are Afghans, SIV applicants, individuals who have the appropriate paperwork to evacuate, and that was just in a 24-hour period.
The World Food Program is also urgently appealing for $200 million to purchase and pre-position food for millions of Afghans before the winter snows cut off access roads to them. Lisa Schlein is up next.
Sizzling summer temperatures of more than 30 degrees Celsius mask the hardships that lie ahead for the Afghan people during the bitterly cold winter season that soon will be upon them. Summer is the time of year when the World Food Program pre-positions food stocks in warehouses and with communities across Afghanistan. The food is then distributed to needy people before access to them is cut off by the brutal winter snows. WFP Deputy Regional Director Anthea Webb warns of a humanitarian catastrophe this winter without international support for this emergency operation.
With funding levels tight and needs escalating, we risk running out of our core supply, wheat flour, come October. We only have a few short weeks left to secure the necessary donor funding to get food in place before the mountain passes are blocked by snow. Any further delay in our preparations could be deadly for the people of Afghanistan.
Once the snow sets in, Webb says it is too late to help communities that will be completely cut off from outside assistance. This hunger crisis comes on top of a wider humanitarian and human rights crisis triggered by the withdrawal of U.S. and NATO troops and the seizure of control of the country by Taliban insurgents. The United Nations reports some 18 million Afghans depend on international aid for survival. Getting that aid into the country during this turbulent period is becoming increasingly difficult as commercial aircraft are unable to land at Kabul Airport. Webb acknowledges the challenges this year are more complex. She says a severe drought, conflict, and the impact of COVID-19 are making it more difficult to make even the most basic preparations for winter.
We know how to prevent a hunger emergency despite the current challenges. Over the past tumultuous week, WFP reached 80,000 people across Afghanistan, notwithstanding the difficulties. That's in addition to the more than 5 million people we've already helped since the beginning of the year.
Webb notes WFP has worked in Afghanistan since 1963, including under the previous Taliban rule. She says WFP has been able to bring 600 metric tons of food and 16 new trucks into Afghanistan this week alone. She adds her agency is ready to scale up aid and ensure families have what they need to survive the harsh winter if it receives the necessary funding. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As the Taliban continues to move forward to create what they're calling an inclusive Islamic government, rights groups continue reporting acts of violence committed by members of the group. Joining us now is Amnesty International's Brian Kastner, Senior Crisis Advisor with the group's Crisis Response Program.
The concern is that we've spent so much time focusing on Kabul and the airport that we really don't know what's going on in the rest of the country. And partly that's because the Taliban have cut cell phone service in many of these areas. And so the only videos and photos that are coming out from large parts of the country are what Taliban-friendly media or social media accounts are putting out. So, you know, for our report, we managed to prove one massacre in one small town in one district in Ghazni. And we just don't know what's happening in other places. But I have a hard time believing that we found the only massacre, right? So I think that there is what's likely is that despite Taliban statements in the capital, that the actual Taliban fighters in large parts of the country are reverting to form and doing what they've always done, in which case it's targeting women, targeting ethnic minorities, targeting people that they think are with the government or journalists or human rights defenders.
So in your opinion, what needs to be done to get aid to those individuals who need it in Afghanistan, given what took place on Tuesday at the United Nations Human Rights Council?
Yeah, the Human Rights Council was extremely disappointing. The situation is changing by the hour and by the day, and they've called for a report to be released in March of next year. It's just absolutely inadequate in every way. So our concern is a few things. One is, as you say, everyone that needs to get out should be getting out. Secondarily, in addition, you know, we're setting the stage for a real humanitarian crisis because there were so many non-governmental organizations that provided the food, that provided the healthcare, that provided the services in a lot of rural Afghanistan. Those networks have completely fallen apart. And so aid is not coming to a lot of places. And then third, I mean, there are many credible reports of the Taliban keeping lists and going house to house and looking for individual journalists, interpreters, people that worked with Western forces, people that spoke to the media or with human rights groups. And those people absolutely need to be protected. And we need to monitor that, you know, if the Taliban say they are not going to be doing these killings and targetings, we need to be monitoring and making sure that's not happening. Last thing is that there's an absolutely heroic effort going on when it comes to the U.S. military and other NATO militaries moving people out by airlift, getting people on the plane, getting them to other places. But that effort is completely wasted if you cannot get everyone through the gate that needs to be gotten through, and if there's nowhere for these people to go once they get on the plane. And so there's a middle section of this puzzle that has been fixed, but at either end, especially when it comes to getting people inside the gate and getting processed, I don't think you can say enough how completely inadequate and unsatisfactory and just horrific it is that people are being turned away because of paperwork and because we can't figure out how to operate a gate and let people inside.
That was Amnesty International Senior Crisis Advisor Brian Kastner. And you're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Afghans seeking refuge from the Taliban's stunning takeover of their country are finding an uneven reception among their country's northern neighbors, welcome in some but turned back from others, or tolerated for only a few hours during refueling stops on the way to Europe or elsewhere. Several Central Asian countries were active participants in the U.S.-led campaign to drive the Taliban from power in Kabul 20 years ago. But aggressive diplomatic efforts by the Taliban in recent years have prompted some of those former Soviet republics to reassess their loyalties. And Russia, with its own political and security interests in the region, is also playing a role. Among the most welcoming to fleeing Afghans is Tajikistan, which is working with UN and other agencies to establish camps and other facilities in two provinces bordering Afghanistan to house up to 100,000 refugees. However, in Uzbekistan, it's a different story. The government says it has received assurances from the Taliban that Afghans returned to their homeland will not be punished, and already several hundred have been sent back since mid-August. Despite its hard line on refugees, Uzbekistan is facilitating evacuation flights bound for other countries. It's allowing the United States, Germany, Russia, Switzerland, Denmark, Poland, Slovakia, and Kazakhstan to use its facilities and airspace, granting landing and overt flight rights while providing logistical services. And one other thing to note, members of the all-female Afghan robotics team escaped Kabul as a team, but landed in completely different countries. And Reuters reporter Rosanna Philpott takes it from here.
Five members of an all-female Afghan robotics team arrived in Mexico. The other team members fled to Doha, Qatar, all escaping an uncertain future at home in Afghanistan, any way they can, after the collapse of the US-backed government and takeover by the Taliban.
We left everything in Afghanistan. We had dreams. We left our families. We left our friends. We left all of our relatives, and without saying any goodbye to them.
The team, made up of girls and women as young as 14, has been heralded for winning international awards for its robots. In March 2020, they started work on an open-source, low-cost ventilator as the coronavirus pandemic hit the war-torn nation. Once approved, the ventilator was supposed to be rolled out in Afghan hospitals. This is Samaya Farouki, captain of the team, speaking in July 2020.
As you know, the coronavirus has become a global crisis today, and people around the world are looking for ways to eradicate it. Most patients with coronavirus die because they cannot breathe. That's why we decided to build a ventilator in Afghanistan, because the number of these machines is low in Afghanistan and other countries. We hope that by building this machine, we will be able to use it in hospitals.
In 2017, the team competed in an academic robotics competition in the US, even though they'd initially been denied visas. At the time, members of the team said they saw the competition as a chance to help improve conditions in Afghanistan, where women and girls often face significant limitations in public and private life. The Taliban, which previously barred girls from schools and women from working when they ruled Afghanistan in the late 1990s, has promised to prioritize women's rights and girls' education. The Islamic militant group seized power in Afghanistan in mid-August as the US and its allies withdrew troops from the country. Western nations are now racing to complete the evacuation of all foreigners and vulnerable Afghans before the expiry of an August 31st deadline agreed with the Taliban. Mexico has pledged to aid Afghan women and girls and says it's begun processing the first refugee applications of Afghan citizens, especially women and girls who've requested it. We give you the warmest welcome to Mexico, were the words of Mexico's Deputy Foreign Minister Marta Delgado as she greeted the robotics team members at Mexico City's International Airport on August the 24th.
Rosanna Philpott of Reuters News. Israel's defense minister has accused Iran of launching a deadly drone strike on an oil tanker from its territory. Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma has those details.
the Mercer Street, an oil tanker that was sailing in the Arabian Sea off Oman, was struck by a drone aircraft on July 29. The attack killed two, a British national and a Romanian. The tanker is managed by a firm owned by an Israeli billionaire. Benny Gantz says Israel's assessment was that the drone was launched from Iranian territory and approved by Iranian leadership. He said Israel has the means to attack and will not hesitate to do so to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus discouraged the administration of COVID-19 booster shots on Wednesday.
First of all, it's not conclusive in terms of its benefits. And also, we don't know if it's safe, and it has been already said. And the second problem is when some countries afford to have a booster and others are not even vaccinating the first and second round, it's a moral issue. And Mike had said it some time ago. It's like saying, okay, you have a life jacket and you're adding one, another one, while others don't have a single life jacket.
But U.S. pharmaceutical company Johnson & Johnson announced on Wednesday that clinical trials it has conducted showed that a second shot of the company's COVID-19 vaccine produced an antibody response 9 times higher than the original single dose. In addition, a new study out of Britain reveals that the effectiveness of both the Pfizer and AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccines diminishes after 6 months. The study found that protection from the two-dose Pfizer vaccine declines from 88% a month after the second dose to 74% after about 5 to 6 months, while the effectiveness of the two-dose AstraZeneca regimen declined from 77% a month after the final shot to 67% after a similar period. A separate study by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows the effectiveness of both the Pfizer and the Moderna COVID-19 vaccines against that highly contagious Delta variant dropped from 91% to 66%. Both vaccines were developed using innovative messenger RNA technology. In Asia, Japan is prepared to expand its current state of emergency to counter a continuing surge of new infections. Officials say that the government will place 8 more prefectures, including Aichi, Hiroshima, and Hokkaido, under a full state of emergency, and that will boost the number of affected prefectures from 13 to 21. Hospitals are also being filled beyond capacity in Tokyo and across the nation, forcing thousands of infected patients to recover at home. In Australia, Sydney's coronavirus infection soared to a pandemic high on Wednesday as officials urged people to get vaccinated to curb hospitalizations. Reuters' Ryan Chung has that part of our coverage.
The state of New South Wales recorded 919 new infections in the past 24 hours. Officials have warned that hospitals in the western suburbs of Sydney, the epicenter of the outbreak, are under pressure. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian urged more people to get vaccinated to ease the strain on the health system.
We've made the point that the most important figure moving forward is the rate of vaccination, and that remains the case. As soon as we hit all those milestones, we will have those extra freedoms.
Despite enforcing 2 months of lockdowns, Sydney is grappling to contain the most recent Delta variant outbreak. Police have been deployed on the streets to enforce social distancing rules as the federal government urges people to get vaccinated. The government has said when the target is reached of 70% of the population above 16 fully vaccinated, restrictions will be relaxed. Australian Treasurer Josh Frydenberg said on Wednesday that the government has no plans to extend emergency economic support to states when they hit that goal. Currently, just under a third of Australians are fully vaccinated.
Reuters reporter Ryan Chong. Niger's defense ministry says that hundreds of Boko Haram militants attacked a military post in its southern region overnight. The ministry says the militants killed 16 soldiers and wounded 9 more. According to a ministry statement, some 50 of the Islamist insurgents were killed in the resulting combat in the West African country's Diffa region. The Boko Haram insurgency broke out in northeastern Nigeria in 2009, but has spilled in the neighboring countries. U.S. officials are continuing to investigate two possible cases of the mysterious Havana syndrome that briefly delayed Vice President Kamala Harris's trip from Singapore to Vietnam. An investigation into the incident is ongoing, but in early stages. Harris's trip across Asia is meant to reassure allies about American foreign policy amid the tumultuous evacuation of Afghanistan. Harris's trip across Asia. The U.S. Supreme Court says the Biden administration likely violated federal law in trying to end a Trump-era program that forces people to wait in Mexico while seeking asylum in the U.S. The court's three liberal judges dissented. The court refused on Tuesday to block a lower court ruling ordering the administration to reinstate the program, informally known as Remain in Mexico. Russia's central regions on Wednesday battled extreme wildfires fueled by an unusual heat wave. It comes after forest fires linked to climate change ravaged Siberia for most of the summer. Russia's emergency ministry said it was fighting 15 wildfires in the Urals region of Sverdlovsk. The region lies on the border of Europe and Asia.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers all over the world were abuzz with excitement in August 2019 after word spread that a comet with origins outside of our solar system was discovered zooming through our solar system. Scientists said the comet called Borisov was found to be traveling over 177,000 kilometers per hour. Now, a new study by a pair of astronomers at the Harvard and Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics suggests that interstellar comets may not be so rare after all. The astronomers calculated that in the Oort cloud, there are more objects from outside the solar system than those from within. The Oort cloud is thought to be a massive debris field surrounding the solar system made up of icy celestial objects located between 0.03 and 3.2 light years away. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A Belgian African company that operates in Burkina Faso is planting trees to help curb desertification and open up lands for grazing for cattle as well as farming. The project by the company, Homme et Terre, or Men and Earth in English, is taking place in Burkina Faso's dangerous conflict zones, where expanding desertification is a cause for strife. Henry Wilkins has that story.
Africa's Sahel region has sometimes been referred to as the canary in the coal mine, capturing early warnings of danger when it comes to the impact of climate change. Now, a Belgian African company that goes by its French name, Homme et Terre, or Men and Earth, is working to curb desert expansion by planting trees and making land usable again in some of Burkina Faso's most conflict-affected areas. Yves Douche is Homme et Terre's program director. She says more people are talking about climate change as something that falls on them and that humans are all responsible for it. There are many things we can do to reduce logging, to control animal grazing, to protect young trees, to improve farming and forestry techniques, to make better use of what we have, she added. The Sahara Desert, which skirts the Sahel to the south, has expanded by 10% over the past 100 years, according to a National Science Foundation study. As land for growing crops and rearing livestock becomes scarcer, it is causing intercommunal violence in countries like Burkina Faso. The violence has contributed to a six-year conflict between the Burkinabe government and groups linked to the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda terrorist organizations. One Homme et Terre worker, who spoke on condition of anonymity, out of concern for his safety, says life had been very hard in his community before the project began. He says things were difficult because there was no work. Farming was not that beneficial. They also tried to find small jobs in livestock as well. By planting trees, locals can make money from producing oil, nuts and seeds. Trees also make the ground fertile again, which means it can be used for farming or raising livestock. But in an often hostile environment where terrorist attacks happen almost daily, Homme et Terre's operations are risky. Another Hometown worker, who also requested anonymity, say community leaders they worked with have lost their lives in violent attacks.
Comme on appelle ça, comme vous avez tout à l'heure présenté nos conseils stratégiques.
He says initially there were 6 strategic advisors working for the company, and now there are 4, he added, asking if visiting VOA reporters have noticed the difference. 2 have been killed since last year. May they rest in peace, he said. Yet those involved with Hometair believe their work is important.
Faut dire que l'action de Hometair est très tellement noble.
What Hometair is doing is very noble and should be saluted, he says. The desert is advancing rapidly into the Sahel, and they're taking on the challenge of recovering a lot of land and allowing animals and people to live properly. Unlike many international organizations with a stated mission of improving lives in Burkina Faso's countryside, Hometair is run for profit. The company says its purpose in restoring degraded land is to foster profitable and sustainable agroforestry in collaboration with local communities. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
The U.S. House of Representatives Select Committee investigating the Capitol riot is demanding a lot of Trump-era records. The AP's Ed Donahue.
The records are from federal intelligence and law enforcement agencies. It includes information about planning and funding for rallies held in Washington leading up to the riot. Among them is an event at the Ellipse January 6th near the White House. Then President Donald Trump spoke.
We will never give up. We will never concede.
Committee members are also considering asking for phone records of several people, including members of Congress, to try to determine who knew what about the unfolding riot and when they knew it. The committee also wants information about pushing the then president's claim of election fraud. Ed Donahue, Washington.
And finally, the last VHS player was produced 5 years ago in July of 2016 by Funai Electric in Japan. But for many, the era of VHS tapes has never ended. Karina Bafrajan rounds us out.
Video rental store Cinephile opened in Los Angeles in 1999. Back then, there were thousands like it. Today, Cinephile is the last independent video rental holdout store in Los Angeles. It's run by Paul Tamayo, a true movie buff.
When I was a little kid, I always told myself that I was going to have, you know, when I grew up and I kind of became a person, I was going to have the biggest collection I could have.
The store has over 50,000 movies, both on VHS tapes and DVD, from Scorsese films to those by Antonioni, Eldar Rязанов, and Andrei Zvyagintsev. He says it's the films you can't get online that draws people to his store.
We have 30,000 titles that you can't stream online, and that really helps us stay afloat. Also, there's a personal touch to coming into a video store. The three of us, we have 3 employees, and we all know our separate genres.
It costs $5 to rent a VHS tape or a DVD at Tamara's store, or for about $30 a month, members can rent as many as 120 movies.
And I've been coming to Cinephile for 20 years. I was here the day they opened. And this is by far the best video rental place in Los Angeles.
These old school movie watchers are a strong subculture. There are online groups and forums where movie lovers sell and buy equipment and talk about the golden age of video. VHS tape collector Heath Holland has a vlog dedicated to the culture of the 1990s.
So many things that were on VHS did not make the upgrade to DVD. Weird things like local, because with VHS, you had the video store boom, and all of these video stores needed content for their shelves. So they're taking regional titles. Like I'm in Ohio. I have local Ohio filmmakers, so I'll stock their things.
These days, VHS tapes cost anywhere from a few dollars to thousands. One online user is trying to sell Disney's Little Mermaid, produced in 1989, for $45,000. No takers yet.
So I think that there might be speculators, around that. And then there are people who collect that material because it's still functional, it's still usable. So you have both the rarity of it, but you also have the material in the tapes themselves that could be used to, make new projects.
It might seem like nostalgia, but Paul Tamayo says he has customers of all ages.
Age doesn't really matter. you feel at home. So there's something about being in a video store, having physical copies of stuff. It's just something comforting.
As comforting as a movie night at home with an old favorite. Kirina Befredjian and Angelina Bogdasaran for VOA News, Washington and Los Angeles.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. And on behalf of our entire production team, thank you for joining us. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.